thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
You are going to have to think some big thoughts for me today. This is John. We're going to play a couple of quizzes. I'm not a big trivia guy anymore, but I've got one for you. Stand by. We're here weekdays from 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 to noon, often with one Don Kleppen. Don't miss the Mincing Rascals podcast. Judge best in the city and the state. Thank you very much, Illinois Broadcasters Association, for saying our Steve Bertrand and Justin Kaufman, people over at the Tribune like Eric Zorn and so forth, some of our friends at the Illinois Policy Institute. We gather together on Thursdays, post that podcast. If you don't listen to podcasts, you should listen to the Mincing Rascals. So, Don, I was on Sunday taking a food tour. Have you done one of these walking food tours of the city before?
No, I haven't. They sound great.
Yeah, don't they, though? So a buddy of mine does some of them. It's with ChicagoFoodPlanet.com. ChicagoFoodPlanet.com. There's your plug, David. It's not why I'm doing this, though. I just think this is kind of interesting. ChicagoFoodPlanet.com does a walking food tour. So you do the one downtown by Streeterville, and you'll get a slice of Malnati's pizza, and they'll tell you about the neighborhood while you're walking over there. Then you go to Al's Beef, and they give you half an Al's roast beef, Italian beef sandwich. And then you get Portillo's hot dog, Garrett's popcorn, some of the signature foods of our city. And you put in about a mile walking around eating this stuff and chatting with folks that you are now meeting. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, that sounds like the best way to do any walking tour is to throw some food in it.
And some bevies. So I did the Wrigleyville brunch tour at Gallagher Way. So that's Gallagher Way is the park adjacent to Wrigley Field. Then they have that big Hotel Zachary next to it on Clark. If you've been over there, you know how developed that is. And there's a bunch of restaurants and places there. So you do a walking tour of all of those joints, eating and sipping as you go. At the end of the tour, the guy, David, said, okay, tell me what the best thing was that you had on the walking brunch tour at Wrigley. And I said it was the strawberry-infused bourbon with lemon and honey.
Wow.
They gave us that drink, I think, at the Hotel Zachary. Other people said it was the egg and veggie hash with potatoes. No meat in there, but it was really hearty. It was really good. That was also at Zachary Hotel on Clark. Pizza from Madden's Corner. You know, that's they told us, and I guess you're not hearing this for the first time, but it's going to stay Madden's Corner, even though Joe Madden's gone now. But he's got right at Clark and Waveland, that little corner restaurant. It's got a second floor as well. And the pizza there is good. It's a flatbread kind of pizza. But unlike a lot of flatbread pizzas, to me anyway, they tend to be kind of dry. This one was really moist. It had a lot going on. There was enough sauce, and the vegetable and meat slices were pretty thick on there. So they weren't cheating you at Madden's Corner. That, for some people, was the best thing we ate. We also had a Southwest chicken nugget in a cone with blue cheese sprinkles at the Brick House. There was a quiche with mushrooms and kale and spinach from Dutch and Doc's that a lot of people liked, but I don't like kale or spinach, so that was a tough one for me. I kind of pushed that one around. And so as we're doing the tour, he's given us some trivia. So here's my trivia question for you. As we're walking down Waveland in the left field corner, so this is Clark and Waveland, say by where Madden's is. Now we're walking towards Wrigley Field. And as we're walking on Waveland, the guide starts to tell us fun facts about home runs hit out of the ballpark onto Waveland Avenue. Now, if you said, what's the longest home run ever hit at Wrigley Field? I think I know the answer to that question. It's Glenn Allen Hill's home run that landed on the roof of one of the rooftops on Waveland. I mean, I remember that. It was May of 2000, and he said that's the fourth longest home run hit at Wrigley. I'm like, holy cow, how am I missing this? He said the third longest home run ever hit at Wrigley Field was Dave Kingman's, of course, King Kong, 1976, April of 76. I don't know if the baseball's bats or players were juiced back then. I don't think they were. Kingman was 6'7", 6'10", and just swinging as hard as he could. And every now and then the wind was blowing out, and he jacked one in April of 1976 that went 532 feet and landed up a few houses on Kenmore. How about that? Sammy Sosa was the second longest. Sosa hit one just a little bit longer. They say maybe 6 feet longer On to Kenmore again, just another door down. Sosa's in June of 2003. Do you remember this one? Bounced into the yard and up to a guy on Kenmore. June of 2003 went 538 feet. That's the second longest home run. What's the longest home run ever hit at Wrigley Field? That is, by whom? Anyone? Bueller? It's not Sosa. It's not Kingman. It's not Mark McGwire. It wasn't Glenn Allen Hill. That was my guess. I'll give you a clue. It wasn't hit by a Cub. It was not hit by a Cub. If I gave you the year, that might give it away. I'm going to give you the year. It was 1959. And it was hit onto the corner of Waveland and Sheffield. So figure, just as you're standing looking at Wrigley Field at the corner of Waveland and Sheffield, that is the center field intersection out there, just to the right of the scoreboard. It went past the scoreboard and out onto the street on the fly at dead right center, left center, if you will.
That is beefy, man.
I know. I'm like, I don't even think that's an option. You can't do that. And the year was 1959. All right, I think we have a correct answer on line one. Our first call says he thinks he knows. Producer Elif is going to give me the name of the person on line one. She's screening the call. It is, who is it? Jimmy? Hey, Jimmy, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Yeah, fine, John. The longest home run hit at Wrigley Field by everybody that you ever talked to, it was hit in 66 by Roberto Clemente. He just missed the center field scoreboard with a TV camera. Supposedly, he just hit one over there.
That's it. It was Roberto Clemente. Just missed the scoreboard. It's sold by it. Now, I have 1959. You say 66, so I won't quibble with you about that, but Roberto Clemente is the right answer. How about that?
Yeah, Roberto Clemente, enough said.
Yeah, I know. His story is so tragic. He was such a good guy. He was such a great player. There was such great play from that man that we didn't get to see because of his premature death. But yeah, Roberto Clemente, longest home run. And you think 562 feet, if we didn't hit 562 feet this year because of the wind, because of the juice balls, because of the launch angles and beefiness of the players, maybe we never will. Maybe we'll never see one longer than 562. That's amazing.
Roberto Clemente, I was at one of the games one time where Jack Clark of the Cardinals in 85 hit one that still might be going. Believe me, my head still twists from that one. But Clemente's, I think they even have it on video, that home run. I think they do. And it's just gone.
You know, the ones that impressed me the most, though, were Kingman's, because Kingman was so tall. He wasn't real muscular, but it seemed to me like he hit him really high. Kingman just launched those things. Like, if you stretch some of Kingman's out on a windy day, I almost think they'd be that long. But he doesn't have the record. It's Roberto. Yeah.
Well, it shows you how hard of a ball Roberto Clemente could hit. Roberto Clemente was a five-tool athlete and was supposed to be on the Olympic team for where the country he was from in like 55 before. Here's the funny thing, because he played for the Pirates, he was actually drafted by the Dodgers. Think about that for a second.
Why? Why would that impress me, him going to Los Angeles?
Well, because Roberto Clemente would have played in L.A., Sandy Koufax and Dreiser, and imagine how much better that team during them years would have been. Think about that for a second.
You know your baseball, don't you, my friend?
Well, I used to be a lifelong season ticket holder, John. I'm the guy who used to bring his big boombox to the bleachers during the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. Actually, it's me. It should become Steger, bud.
So, could you do that anymore? I wonder if they'd let you.
Unfortunately, due to illnesses and other things, no, I'm not able to do that. But a lot of the players and media personnel have gotten on over the earth. They pretty much know who I am because I'm still on videos all from all over. So it's kind of still funny. People actually will recognize me or my voice. So it's pretty funny.
I wonder if the Cubs would let you bring a boombox in there and blast it in the bleachers.
I doubt it because of everything. But, you know, it's the way life moves on. It's okay, but I saw the videos and stuff of me, so I'm good with it. And the photos, I'm cool with it. Plus, I know a lot of players and, you know, different media people who know me, so I'm good with it. It's cool.
Hey, listen, I got to go. I'm going to give you Lou Malnati's pizza. You hold the line. Talk to producer Elif, okay?
You're the best, John. My wife and I love Lou Malnati's. Thank you very much.
It's nice of you to call. Well, he knew more than I did. Hey, Jim, you're on WGN. This is a funny way to put it. Hey, Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, I always thought that Arnold Palmer hit the farthest ball in Wrigley Field.
I think you're right. That's kind of cheating, though, now, isn't it?
Yeah, but the longest home run ever I heard was 666 that Mickey Mantle did out of Yankee Stadium.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was going to look that one up, too. What's the farthest anybody ever hit one? The thing is, I don't know how good they were at measuring back then. We seem to be a little more scientific about everything now. And isn't this also true? Say Glenn Allen Hill's home run hits the roof on Waveland, right? My understanding is they measure the home run from where it hits. That is, from home plate to that spot on the roof is, in Glenn Allen Hill's case, what did I say, 532 feet. Let's see, Glenn Allen was they estimated 500. But if that hadn't hit the roof, it would have traveled, good Lord, another 20, 30 feet for sure, right? I mean, it's coming down at an angle. And that roof is three stories high. So you've got to think Glenn Allen Hills would have gone longer still. I think they should chart the trajectory of that and project how much further it would have gone had it landed on the ground. Because balls that land on the ground will always have an advantage. They'll travel farther. You see what I'm saying? And nobody's resolved that point for me. Thank you for the call. It's 118 on WGN. We will, after the news at 2:30, do our little transportation quiz and hand out a prize then, too. We're going to start doing that on Mondays. They will always be about Chicago. We will always do it on Monday in the 2 o'clock hour. And today it's about transportation, about the roads all around us. John took the quiz just before he and I traded on the air, or just after he and I visited on the air. And of the 10 questions, he got 9 3/4 of the 10 right. I said, "You're good at this." He said, "Well, I used to be a traffic reporter." I said, "Oh, forgot that. That's almost cheating, John Hansen." But he did real well. How well will you do in knowing your Chicago? That's after 2:30 on WGN. And the Sun-Times today, as we get closer to the holidays, two grocery store chains, it is announced, are offering a spirited way to get ready for Christmas. Aldi and Kroger will sell limited edition wine advent calendars in November, offering holiday revelers a way to drink in conjunction with the Advent, the religious days leading up to Christmas Eve.
That's got to be a giant calendar.
Last year's calendar weighed 21 pounds.
That's the chocolate I want to have right there.
No, that's the wine.
Whoa, either way.
That would be a lot of chocolate for sure.
Kroger's first ever Oh What Fun holiday wine countdown calendar goes on sale November 1st. It contains 24 mini bottles of festive blends of red, white, and sparkling wines for $80, the retailer said. Only 16,000 calendars will be produced. It will not be restocked. Once it's sold, they're gone. When these calendars are gone, they're gone. For Aldi, this is the second year. That's the Kroger version. For Aldi, this is the second year its stores will sell the wine and cheese calendars. Those sold out within minutes across the country last year. This year, the discount grocer has a new edition, a beer advent calendar. Because Americans really haven't found a way to consume alcohol in excess, better to just put it right on the calendar so you never miss a day.
Don't forget. It's a little reminder.
I could see your medications. How about an advent calendar with, you know, your heart pill, your blood pressure pill, all of those. But no, we're doing beer and wine. Toy, cheese, and chocolate calendars also will return, along with a new advent calendar with dog treats, according to the Aldi website. They say those go on sale at Aldi's November 6th. The wine calendar, which will have 24 bottles of wine, will cost $69.99. The beer advent calendar, $49.99. The cheese advent calendar, $14.99. May not be available. It says it may not be available in all stores. Prices may vary depending on location. Last year's wine calendar weighed 21 pounds. It cost $69.99. After the calendar sold out in stores last year, some appeared on eBay at a premium, with at least one selling for $300 plus $51 shipping. So $350 to get 24 little airline bottles of wine. When you could just run to Benny's and pick them up, I don't know, then get out a piece of masking tape and write December 1st, December 2nd on there. You can do it however you want. As we get closer to the next election, and this is something that we'll talk about on the show a little later this week, but I'll just sort of wet your brain on this. There's a piece in the Chicago Tribune's website about a guy in Indiana who, after he votes, posts pictures of his ballot.
Isn't that illegal?
He got a call from the election board saying it's illegal. He said, no, it's not. The Supreme Court ruled that unconstitutional, the law that said you cannot share your ballot in 2015. I'm reading from the Tribune now. That election official maintained that the law is still in effect in Indiana. Dothiger, that's this guy's last name, a nice young man, again disagreed. He left the office to retrieve his smartphone so he could show the official the court opinion on the issue. It explicitly states that posting a marked ballot is protected by the First Amendment, he told her. But that official then pulls out the state's code book so both of them could read the relevant law. A person who knowingly does any of the following commits a level 6 felony, shows a ballot after it is marked to another person in such a way as to reveal the contents. So, yes, it is against the law to do that. I'm not sure that it should be. I think a lot of people do that not so much to electioneer as to just encourage other people to vote. Right. I mean, I don't know what this guy's motivation was. I think he was doing it as a matter of sort of civic pride. But if I vote for candidate X and then I post it right away, maybe on social media, people will see that and it will encourage them to vote that way.
Yeah, maybe, I think it's the thought process of swaying anyone's opinion.
Well, you think these guys are going to spend $100 zillion with commercials and signs and everything. I can't post my... What do you think about that, Lauren? Should we be able to share our ballot on social media?
Well, it kind of goes back to what's real and what's not, right? So if it was legal, think about how many posts could be fake.
Yeah, we can fake people's faces and voices.
It's true.
You could just doctor a thing and say, I voted straight Republican or straight communist or straight anything, right?
Right.
You could put Blagojevich on the ballot and it would have me voting for Blago, which I don't tend to do. It's 129 into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom in a minute. And then after this, I'm really excited about this next conversation we're having. We're inviting back a guy named Paul Tough. He wrote The Years That Matter Most. And it's about raising your kids and especially getting them to and through school. There's a school in Chicago, he says, does more to prepare kids for life after school than any school he's run across. Now, what are they doing and what school is that? This will surprise you.
Let's put the cheese on the cracker here.
There's a lot of dark clouds that are coming our way in the near future here.
Crying out loud, it's embarrassing. Oh, I mean, this is, I'm telling you, this one's going to reek. All I'm telling you is this. This team, I'd like to buy them for what they're worth and sell them for what they think they're worth.
We got totally outcoached and totally outplayed today.
You know, I heard Dick is spouting off this week. Oh, yeah, this is one of the greatest defenses I've ever done. Maybe better than... Where's $141 million Khalil Mack?
Frankly, that's embarrassing that you're wearing a pro jersey.
How dare you?
Oh, I mean, this is... I'm telling you, it's embarrassing.
How dare you?
Where's the Tylenol?
Three bears sitting at a Lockport bar. Three Grabowskis named Obradovich, Kozlowski, and Hampton breaking down the Bears' play. Actually, we didn't do the Bears postgame show. The three Bears weren't on WGN radio yesterday after the game. We had Blackhawks hockey, so we didn't get a chance to hear them wax. Some highlights from some previous games this year. Some of those are actually from the show after a win, just to go... Which just goes to show how angry they would have been yesterday after that loss to the Saints. There's no shame in losing to the Saints. There is a lot of shame, say Bears experts and fans, in playing the way we're playing! Playing the way we're playing!
Yeah, you kind of need an offense in the NFL.
Yeah, as it turns out, our defense has, you know, been almost enough to get us through some games, but it really would be good if the one tall guy would throw the ball to one of the other guys, and they would catch it, and then they would get points.
That'd be cool.
That'd be cool. That would be cool.
I mean, I know it's asking a lot, but come on.
What was the article? Was it Brad Biggs or somebody said in the Tribune today, everything that you're hearing that's bad about the Bears is deserved. So tough day to be a Chicago Bear in this city. Not that long ago, Paul Tough was in our studio. Do you remember the author and the book, The Years That Matter Most? He had some really fascinating things to say about getting your kids. Actually, he's been writing about you and your kids for a while, but getting them through school and getting them through the school years, through college for that matter. And I said, listen, if you're ever in town again, if there's ever occasion for you to visit with us, come visit with us. He took me up on that. Paul, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Nice to be back.
For those who missed our conversation, what's The Years That Matter Most about?
It is about the intersection of higher education and social mobility in the United States. So how our system of colleges and universities helps and hinders young people, especially young people who are coming from low-income and first-generation working-class families. Higher education used to be the great engine of social mobility. Now that engine is in lots of ways breaking down.
Are you saying people should or shouldn't send their kids to college?
Well, it is very hard right now to make it into the middle class without some kind of post-secondary credential. So I definitely think that sending your kids to college is important. But we have created all of these barriers to helping young people get there.
Like what?
Well, the cost is a big part of it. We are not investing as much. The public is not investing as much in higher education as we used to. So our system of community colleges and public universities doesn't first cost more than it used to and doesn't work as well as it used to. And then the most selective institutions have all kinds of incentives that make it incline them to admit more well-off students and fewer low-income students.
Which is one of the surprises to me in your book. Another one was that, what is it, the graduation rate of community colleges. Do I have this right? Do you know that statistic off the top of your head? I think I do. I think it's 20%.
I think that's right, yeah. It's very low.
What are you saying? Father, you say no, it's not 20%?
Yeah, for urban community colleges, it's 7%.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, I'm a community college graduate, and it was one of the best education decisions my family ever made for a lot of reasons. But I also thought that community college is easier to do. That is, you don't have to go away to school for a lot of the kids. It's not financially oppressive, et cetera, et cetera. How are community... I think I know the answer to that. Tell me if this is it. That a lot of people aren't going to community college to get a two-year degree, maybe. They're doing it because they just want to take extension classes or further themselves. The objective is different. Is that it?
I think that's part of it. But I also think that we have created a system that makes it just harder for students to make it through. We used to invest a lot more in community colleges, so there were more opportunities, more classes offered, just better ways to make it through. Now we make it a lot harder.
It was a terrible introduction of Father Steve Kasturis, who's sitting next to you. He is the dean of Arupe College at Loyola University. Kasturis, is that how I say your
last
name? That's
it. Thank you.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Why did you write about him?
Because I think that Arupe College, which Father Kasturis started, helped start, has a different kind of model for a two-year college that is unlike anything else in Chicago, unlike anything else in the country, and provides a much better opportunity, especially for low-income first-generation students.
What are they doing? What are you doing differently for low-income or first-generation students?
So a couple of things about our students, all Chicagoans, all commuters. Students who are coming to us primarily from CPS or from charter schools, maybe 13% from Catholic high schools, all fresh out of high school. So these are 18, 19-year-old traditional age students desiring college, as Paul said, first gen. GPAs in high school, 2.7, 2.8, maybe 2.9, much lower than Loyola University of Chicago.
ACTs are 17 or 18?
ACT 17, SAT 920.
What is it for the typical Loyola student?
So the ACT for a typical Loyola student is a 27, 28. I don't have the SAT number.
Wow, that's a gap. So it's harder for these kids maybe to acclimate to college.
So that's where we come in. We're smaller. We are currently at 350 students in first and second year.
Arupe is.
Correct. And we offer a lot of wraparound support services, starting with a very robust orientation where our students begin to build community. And one of the things that Paul writes about so eloquently, both in How Children Succeed and in his new book, is that sense of belonging. No matter what your background is, if you don't feel like you belong on a campus, it'll be difficult for you to persist and to complete successfully at that college, university. So that is really our ethos at Arupe.
Arupe is a college within Loyola. Is
correct.
It on the? Is it a separate building? How does that work?
Yeah, so we are at the Water Tower campus of Loyola Chicago. We're in the corner of Pearson and State. We're in the old. It was the law school. And then the law school moved down the street, and then it was the business school, and then they moved across the street, and now I shared the building with the School of Social Work. And that's really quite deliberate, putting together the synergies from two different academic units. MSW students from Loyola School of Social Work intern with us. They earn their hours. We receive their services. So it's been a great benefit for both.
Do these kids take courses like the courses that Loyola University or traditional university students
would
take?
Yeah, that's a great question. So these are general ed requirements. They're taking the exact same courses that their counterparts are taking at Loyola Chicago's Lakeshore campus in the Rogers Park neighborhood. The delivery is different, much more predictable. Also, you're in a morning cohort or an afternoon cohort, and that is sensitive to commuters and also to students who are working, and many of our students have to work. Even though our price point is such that we've designed this so that it's so affordable. Our students are Pell and MAP and SEOG eligible. The average out-of-pocket for the student is under $1,700 a year.
Well, that description you gave with all those acronyms is defining low-income students.
Monetary assistance program, that's state aid in this in Illinois, and SEOG is a supplemental educational opportunity grant, which is federal aid.
And are these kids going to school for 4 years? Is Arupe 4 years?
It's a two-year program, so they get their we're a bridge program, so our students are coming to us right out of high school, and they need that extra support that we provide for 2 years. And most of them desire to go on to a four-year institution. 88% of our – we've graduated three classes. We opened this in 2015, so we've been in existence now for – we're in our fifth year. We've graduated three classes. 88% of our graduates continue on to four-year institutions, including
88% of the graduates.
That's right.
What percentage of them, in fact, graduate?
So our first cohort, I was just sharing this with Paul, our first cohort graduated from Arupe in 2017 with their associate's degrees. Now, nationally, those who begin community colleges, only 27% of them complete their bachelor's degrees in 6 years' time. We're at 49% completing their bachelor's degrees in 4 years' time, 2 years with us for the associates and then 2 years at the four-year institution. And we're forecasting over 80% of that first cohort completing their bachelor's in 5 years' time.
These students are selected based on their academic achievement. Are you getting the high academic achievers coming out of CPS?
So remember, our GPAs are 2.7, 2.8, 2.9. These are B-minus, C-plus, C students, students that don't have a lot of options. And they're recommended by faculty members, by their college counselors in their high schools. We require that all the students come in for an interview, and we're looking for that student, first of all, who shows up and then who is, demonstrates grit, resilience. They really want to do this. There's something there.
But did you also say in your book that they're not looking for the kids that have sufficient assistance, maybe coming out of CPS? It's kids that fall through the cracks.
Absolutely. I mean, so what I think those numbers express is that these are not the top students from any of those CPS schools. I mean, these are students, as Father Katsouris is saying, that want to learn, that are committed to their education, but they are not the top scoring students and not the top students in their class.
So what happens to these kids typically? Were it not for Arupe, where would they be? Where would they be
going?
That's
a great question. A lot of them get into, low-paying jobs that, for a while they're contributing to their family's overall income, and working in fast food is great when you're 18 or 19, but if you plateau there, we can sort of see where that's going. Or they enroll in our city colleges, and, I am a fan of the city colleges. We have the same goal. We're trying to graduate, more and more of Chicago's population, but they get lost there. We have an enrollment of 350. We don't have an enrollment of 3,000 or 13,000. We're designed so that our students meet with their academic advisors very regularly. City colleges in Chicago, New York, Baltimore, San Francisco, the academic advisors are overwhelmed. They have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of advisees. So, in those settings, you're meeting with your academic advisor once during the entire course of enrollment. And when you're first gen, when your parents are navigating all of this for you, when you've got competing claims on your time with commuting or childcare or work, then your academic program is not getting the attention that it needs.
you write about this, Paul, that, and it's something that, you know, I think is a light that maybe should shine in our minds when we think about this more often. That is, if you say, hey, get yourself an education, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, there's programs available. So many parents who have underachieved in their lives academically, they break out in a rash when they walk through a school door. They're not against their kids bettering themselves, but they are, they have bad memories about school settings, and they literally don't know how to pass along positivity or help kids with algebra because they failed in school themselves. And so this whole idea of telling that next generation, hey, go to school, take advantage of these opportunities, is uniquely alien to those families, right?
You're right. And I think you're also right that part of it is practical, just sort of how you think about college, how you fill out financial aid forms, all of those things that first-generation families are less likely to know about. But part of it is psychological as well, that colleges are sort of set up to be threatening to people who don't have a background.
Well, you called it a psychological minefield. Here's you writing in your book. But on the other side, there is the psychological minefield of being an American 18-year-old and the particular strengths and burdens and complexities each one brings to campus. I mean, in the best of, my dad was a junior college counselor. Mm-hmm. I had it made. I had it made. My dad signed me up for the classes and helped me through that until I finally went to Carbondale. Nobody could have had an easier path. I had all kinds of anxiety. Imagine if it was 180 different. It would have been torturous. It might have been something I would just not have done. And that's where these kids are.
Right. And that's what I think is so important about Arupe, because we do not, as a country, we do not have a solution for these students. And all of the ways that the higher education system has changed is just put all the pressure on them that, okay, you figure it out with your families, you figure out how to pay for it. And that is just a huge burden to place on those
students. Now what I'm thinking is, okay, we want these kids to be successful. So where do you set the bar academically, achievement-wise, grading-wise? I mean, I think I would be too easy. If you're too hard, maybe you're setting them up for failure. Gentlemen, talk to me about that after this. We're visiting with Steve Katsouris. He's the dean of Arupe College, which you'll find at the Loyola campus downtown, mm-hmm. and is a unique school just a few years in existence. Paul Tough introduced me to him. Paul is the author who's been in our studio before. We'll pick it up here next on WGN. Let me mention this while I am thinking about it. So the reason that I think Paul brought Steve here, Father Steve from Arupe College at Loyola University, Paul Tough, the author of The Years That Matter Most, previously How Children Succeed, is because are both of you speaking this evening at the school?
We are.
So there is a book signing and a talk being given on the importance of Arupe College. You can register online for the event at LUC, think Loyola University Chicago, luc.edu/Arupe, A-R-R-U-P-E. I'll put all of this on my Facebook page, too. It's at 5:30 tonight. At 1 East Pearson. So is that the address for
the
school downtown?
That's right, Pearson and State.
Yeah, so downtown Chicago, 5:30 tonight. So these gentlemen will be there. You should be, too. Who should be there? Who's this talk geared to, then?
I mean, I think to everyone in the city who's interested in new solutions for higher education. I mean, certainly anyone whose family is themselves interested in Arupe. But, I mean, the reason that I'm interested in Arupe is I think that it for everyone, it gives you a different model about how to think about higher education.
Yeah, but I think when we think about higher education, we think, well, find your school, then work real hard, get real good grades. Arupe seems to nurture the kids more.
So one of the quotes from Steve that I have in the book is that he says that Arupe has a very intrusive culture, and that is not something. So I went around and talked to a lot of administrators, a lot of different colleges and universities, and that is not a phrase that you often hear.
Yeah,
we're really
kidding.
Intrusive. You know, mostly colleges take this point of view that, like, we just pull back and let our students sink or swim. And that works for some students, but there are a lot of students that it doesn't work for, who need more help, more support, more connection. And that, I think, is what makes Arupe different.
This will sound condescending. I don't mean it to. But each of these kids must be these little projects. You want to sort of rescue them from the pitfalls of the city and city life. I mean, this must be the most challenging, frustrating, and rewarding thing you or an educator can do.
Well,
because
it's
both fronts, isn't it?
It certainly is very rewarding. As Paul said, this is a very innovative entrepreneurial activity in Jesuit higher ed or in higher ed in general. And, you know, in terms of Rescuing, I would say accompanying. So, look, I'm a Jesuit priest, I'm a Catholic, Pope Francis is my hero. He talks a lot about accompanying people, and accompanying people he will talk about on the margins. So a lot of our students are on the margins of higher ed. They would never dream of going to a private liberal arts college like Loyola University. But we are accompanying them during their first post-secondary education experience. And quite frankly, we are learning a lot from them, from their experience, about how to deliver higher ed more effectively.
First post-secondary educational experience for some families. I mean, these kids are sort of the point of the spear for some of these families. So then what about my idea? I so want to get these kids to succeed, have that sheepskin to enter the work world, that I think I might compromise their learning because I would be too easy. But if I was too strict, what good does it do to fail them? So how do you find that balance is my question.
So our curriculum is very rigorous. As I said, it's the same as the curriculum that their classmates at Loyola's main campus would also be taking. Our delivery is different, very high touch. More contact hours with professors. One of the things that we have found is this, you know, if you say to a student, oh, well, go to the writing center where you need a math tutor. For some students, oh, I've been tutored all my life, or where's my academic coach? For these students, that's confirmation that, in fact, they don't belong at a campus like Loyola University. So we have peer tutors, students who are a year ahead of them, who look like them, who went to their high schools, who commute with them, who are really good in math or in writing, saying, look, let's meet after class and let's work on your paper together. That has been transformative for our program and for our students.
Somebody just texted in, only Chicagoans eligible for this?
It's a commuter school. Yeah.
So I guess if I wanted to move here from Idaho, I could, but it's an enrollment process. Less than half of the kids that apply get accepted, correct?
That's right.
Which is good for you, I guess. It shows how needed this is.
It's an indication of the great need for programs like this.
Gentlemen, we're out of time. So Paul Tough's books are How Children Succeed. That was half a dozen years ago. His latest is The Years That Matter Most, and talks about these issues. It's in his book that I met Steve Katsouris, who is the dean of Arupe College at Loyola University. 5:30 tonight, they're speaking in downtown at the downtown campus. Go to luc.edu/Arupe, spell Arupe with two R's. Gentlemen, congratulations. Stay in touch, Father. We'll do this conversation again sometime.
Right, I would enjoy that. Thank you.
Keep writing, too.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you both.
Here's John Williams.
Got to turn that little knob up if you want to hear the radio show. This is John. I was just reading a text. This will change something I said moments ago. Stand by for a radio correction. It's 208. We're downtown Chicago in the 18-story Skyline Studio overlooking a kind of misty autumn day. Feels a little like spring to me, actually. Autumn to me is a little cooler than this. At least it was that way when I was walking over here. But there is sort of my skyline view for you. You know, we were talking earlier about the longest home runs hit at Wrigley Field for a couple of reasons. I did a tour over there, and the guide was giving out trivia. And as he was doing so, he said the four longest home runs hit at Wrigley Field. And I thought I knew the number one. I thought that was Glenn Allen Hills. Hit back in, when was it, about mid-80s. Glenn Allen Hills, the one that landed on the roof of a building, one of the rooftops over there on Waveland, was the fourth longest. Third longest was a Dave Kingman home run. Second longest was a Sammy Sosa home run, or maybe it was two and three, but those are the three. Glenn Allen Hill, Dave Kingman, when he was a Met, mind you, and Sammy Sosa. The longest home run, I said, our guide said, was hit by whom? And that was by Roberto Clemente of the Pittsburgh Pirates a long time ago. And then I just offered this observation about that, that my understanding is when they measure longest home runs, they measure from home plate to wherever it hit. So a ball that hits a building doesn't get to travel as far, but that's where they measure it. Steve Alexander, who fills in for Big O a lot here, sometimes does news, Steve Alexander sent me a text. According to the Google, MLB home run distance is measured from home plate to the place where the ball landed or where it would have landed had its flight not been obstructed. So I don't want to lead you astray as we go forward in our lives. Know that they do calculate it the way I had hoped, where it would have landed. The Glen Allen Hill home run that landed on the roof of a building off of Waveland would have gone a lot further, except it hit the third story of that building. A friend of ours named Carol It was her building that it landed on, as I recall. She thereafter went by the nickname Rooftop Carol. So thanks for the heads up on that, Steve Alexander. A couple of texts about our guests a little while ago. We were talking with the guy in charge of Arupe College downtown. It's done in conjunction with the folks at Loyola, and it's for the B-minus students, if you will, in the Chicago area, who might fall through the cracks. You know, they're not rich enough or getting good enough grades to get great assistance, but they do want to go to school. A lot of them, the first in maybe their family, to try and go to college after high school. So how do they get through that? And Arupe is uniquely qualified to do that. John, are only Chicago residents eligible for Arupe? Well, the father said it's a commuter college. Steve Katsouris says it's a commuter college, so you know there's no dorms. But I guess if you found a way to get to Chicago, you could apply. But less than half of the applicants get in. It's tough. John, so glad you have the dean of Arupe on. This is an amazing program. This texter from 708 said, hey, I saw Clay Jenkinson on The American Experience. He's the guy that does our Teddy Roosevelt and Thomas Jefferson shows. He was on The American Experience on TV. The show is about Teddy Roosevelt's trip up the River of Doubt in the Amazon. He really added to the details of that part of his life, and that voice and those looks ain't bad either, says 708. Yeah, Clay's a pretty good-looking guy, and he does have a great voice. And when Ken Burns and national shows on PBS or elsewhere do, you know, programs about Roosevelt or Jefferson, they will often turn to the guy that we call on to do them on stage. If you ever get a chance to see us have those conversations with Teddy Roosevelt or Thomas Jefferson, this is a nice way for me to remind you to do that. What else are we going to mention here? Oh, gosh, if you've been following this story, it's kind of breaking, but this is embarrassing. This is just embarrassing. So this is the story. Did you see what's trending today about Mitt Romney?
Yes.
This is hilarious, isn't it? Okay, I'll just read from the Chicago Tribune story. Allison Chu. For years, Pierre Delectos, D-E-L-E-C-T-O, Pierre Delectos' presence on Twitter largely went unnoticed. Operating a bare-bones account with the handle at QAWS, Quaz9876, that's an unusual handle. The user's limited activity revealed only an interest in politics, namely supporting Senator Mitt Romney, the Republican senator from Utah. So when Pierre Delectos started trending on Sunday on social media platforms, people were understandably confused. Why are we talking about Pierre Delectos? One person asked. Another wanted to know, quote, what the heck is a Pierre Delectos and why is everybody talking about it? On Sunday, Twitter users lost their collective minds when they learned that Pierre Delectos was not a bot or a random Romney superfan, but an account run by the Republican senator himself. As Delecto, Romney, who has become one of President Trump's most vocal GOP critics, used the account to like critical tweets about the president, while also occasionally defending himself against detractors. By early Monday, the unusual pseudonym was was a trending moment on Twitter and had been mentioned in more than 47,000 tweets. The Romney-Delecto connection was first made by Slate's Ashley Feinberg, who was hunting for the secret account after the senator mentioned its existence to The Atlantic in a profile published on Sunday. So The Atlantic does a story with Romney about Romney and about this new version of Romney, talking tough to the president. He mentions this Twitter supporter, Delecto, and somebody thinks, oh, I've never heard of Delecto. Who's that supporting him? They start to do their homework. I'm telling you what, if you do not already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper or a magazine or patronize the sponsors of a news talk radio station, for that matter.
Why do they think they can get away with it? Like, why do they think they're not going to get caught?
Right. Really?
Totally anonymous. I'm just going to say all this great stuff. No one's going to know it's me.
I know. And the perfect mask will be Delecto. I mean, what is that?
For the record, I think there's probably already a band that's changed its name to the Delecto-Romney Connection.
I mean, so many people have admitted to having troll accounts, definitely don't cite them as a supporter if you know that you're behind it.
Right. The one account which is constantly, you know, supporting Mitt Romney, the one Twitter account always behind his back.
Delecto's on my side again. I'll tell you what, it's a who's who of people in the media in Chicago who have been busted for either boosting their Twitter following by buying accounts or by tweeting as somebody else in favor of themselves. And you have no excuse for that in 2019. You really didn't in 2018, and I don't think you did in 2017. And Mitt Romney, of all people, I mean, he's just so square cut. He looks like Beaver Cleaver's dad. He looks like Ward. He's sort of this all-American homespun, graying on the sides, 1950s dad, who you don't think would be very good at Twitter anyway. That's one of the great mysteries about Donald Trump. Mystery isn't the right word, but it's just kind of ironic that where social media is really the domain of younger people, the oldest man in politics right now, Donald Trump, is a whiz at it. And when he makes mistakes, he doesn't care. You know, it's not like he's hiding. He doubles down on his errors. He doesn't fix his typos and grammatical miscues. Trump just full speed ahead.
He's like Twitter personified.
Exactly.
Really.
It's like, heck with you. I'm going to do it anyway. And then there's Mitt Romney skulking around the edges with the handle of Delecto. Delecto. I mean, it sounds naughty, Mitt. Do you at least acknowledge that? I don't know where that came from. It should have just been Biff Henderson or something like that.
Yeah, not some comic book villain name.
Delecto is a comic book villain. The Romney-Delecto connection. You're right. That's a new band. I'm going to learn to play the guitar just so I can form a band and make it the name. Was first made in Slate, following up on a profile in The Atlantic. C'est moi, Romney said after being asked about Delecto. Well, that makes him just that much more appealing to the common man. C'est moi.
Speaking French, yep. Totally American thing to do, man.
Mitt, I don't know if you were thinking about running for president again, but this doesn't bode well, my friend. When reached for comment late Sunday, a spokesperson for Romney responded by emailing the Washington Post a link to a tweet from Coppens that contained Romney's brief confirmation. Romney brought up his covert Twitter persona during an interview with The Atlantic as he discussed Trump lashing out at him on social media. The 72-year-old senator has condemned Trump for allegedly attempting to get officials in Ukraine to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and his son and so forth. In response, Trump has labeled Romney as a pompous ass and called for his impeachment, though senators can't be impeached. But that's how you do Twitter. Trump knows how to do Twitter. Impeach Romney. You can't, but that doesn't matter.
Right. Just throw out something
this
salacious.
Is Twitter.
Yep.
According to Coppens, Romney shrugged off Trump's insults and grabbed an iPad off his desk during the interview. He explained that he uses a secret Twitter account, what do they call me, a lurker, to keep tabs on the political conversation. The senator declined to name the account, noting that he was following 668 people, listing journalists, late-night comedians, and athletes. That's another way to sort of, I don't know, advertise your currency, is to say, well, here's who I'm following.
Why couldn't he just do that on his own account?
Yeah, I'm not sure that saying I have a fake account to see what other people are saying about me is a smart play. But those slim details were more than enough for Feinberg, who previously discovered that former FBI director James Comey was on Twitter, and he used the alias Reinhold Niebuhr.
What the heck, man?
Where are they coming up with these names?
I would have gone with Slenderman 12 if I were Comey.
I think you've got maybe a twin bill concert at, one of the smaller clubs in town there, Don Kleppen. It'll be, I guess, Reinhold Niebuhr opens up for the Romney.
Yeah, Reinhold would be the opener. That's the empty bottle for sure. That's a show there.
The process, Feinberg wrote, hinged on the assumption that Romney, a known family man, that's a funny half phrase, would want to keep close tabs on his offspring Instead of targeting his family members with tens of thousands of followers, Feinberg homed in on public accounts belonging to Ali Romney Critchlow, the senator's oldest grandchild. So if you want to follow your kids or grandkids, rather than follow them on your account, which might shine a brighter light on them if you're somebody famous, you create a fake persona, and then you can follow people that way. Okay, I'm learning as I go here, but really, I don't think that's what Mitt's agenda was.
Yeah, I can't talk to my grandkids. I'm just going to create a new Twitter account and creep on them that way.
I follow, my sons don't use social media much. I do follow one on Twitter. And every now and then I will see things that I go, oh, there's a little window into your soul or psyche or diet, you know, or entertainment. But when my kids were on Facebook, and either of them are now, I know Grant's not. I don't know if Griffin is. But that was kind of a big thing. You know, will you accept a friend request from your parents? And my thought was not to. My thought was to stay away from your kids on social media. You know, trust that and let them have that space. Don't be in the room with them. I mean, really, think about that. I don't know if this is a big deal anymore. Is it, Elif? Is following your kids, liking your kids on Facebook still a sort of, I don't know, decision point for families these days?
I think if you're an appropriate age to be using those accounts where you might see things that are inappropriate, it's okay. Because you're an adult, and right. As long as you're an adult, let's just put it that way.
Right, so if your kids are old enough to be doing those things, that ship has sailed. You don't need to be looking over their shoulder on social media.
Yeah, but I have a cousin who has a kid that has his own smartphone and is on Instagram, and my sister blocked him from her stories because she used profanities sometimes, yeah. And he called her out, and he's 11, 12 years old.
Right, your sister uses those, and she doesn't want him seeing that.
So she blocked him from her stories, and then he got offended.
I'm sure he did.
And then his parents stepped in.
Well, I'm not sure if, see, that's. I guess that's really the point, is should an 11-year-old be on those platforms, right?
Right.
I would say no.
Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, I've definitely flagged some things for his parents that I've seen him like on those things, like, you know, where you like, quote unquote. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe you should monitor this a little bit more closely.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And it's
Aunt
like,
Elif, thanks a lot.
I know.
Well, Narc.
I don't want my my 11-year-old nephew seeing everything that Lizzo posts.
All right, so answer this with a number, everybody. And I know kids are different one from the other, but what's the age where you let them play in that space?
14, 15.
Elif was starting with a 16, 17?
Yeah, 16.
I think 16, 17 is good idea. Good luck with you on that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's
it's not realistic.
Work.
It's a good age. In my mind, I'm thinking high school, right? You know, because if half the high schoolers are doing it, but the other half aren't, it's going to be hard to convince them to not even like sneak their way into having an account like that.
Help us out with this. Here's a number. Go ahead, Don, jump in there. What's the number for you?
Oh, I was going to say the same thing, about 14 or 15 because of the high school thing.
312-981-7200. Call or text. Give us some advice. Give everybody some advice on this, please. 312-981-7200. WGN. I'll take the break here, Elif. You can call me now. John Niebuhr wrote the Serenity Prayer and said in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, no kidding, I did not know that. So that handle isn't a complete fabrication. At least it was somebody. John Reinhold Niebuhr, N-I-E-B-U-H-R. I didn't know that. A theologian. John, I joined Facebook as a freshman in high school. My mom's rule was I had to be friends with people from church, family or family friends to keep me accountable. Yeah, I suppose that would work.
Well, remember how it even started is you had to be in college and you would have to invite other people to join the platform.
Say that again?
When Facebook first was around, it was only for people in college.
Right, right.
And you would have to personally invite someone else to join. You couldn't just join.
I forgot about that. I'm playing the movie back in my head now, yeah.
Yeah, it was a long time ago because that officially changed pretty much when I was first in high school because I also joined when I was a freshman, and that was 2004,
2003, 2004? Yeah. You know, somebody says this, for instance, Lauren. They say, John, in terms and conditions, the terms and conditions, don't you have to be 18 to have one of these accounts? that doesn't much matter, though.
Yeah, it's
right?
Just a click of a button.
I say college-age kids have fun. That being said, I have two high school girls. I am on whatever they are on. I rarely check, but I remind them before they post, do you want your mom to see this? They need to learn to not post stuff. I think you should at least go back. I don't care who you are, where you are in life. Go back and clean your stuff up if you're applying for a job or if you get a new girlfriend.
Right. Because I do think that
the parents or somebody's going to look you up.
Right. I think we've been better about training kids to think that way. So it's gotten better, but definitely still some people that don't follow that.
And then we have Mitt Romney. What was the name again? Delecto? Pierre Delecto? Pierre Delecto. All right. Our little quiz. We'll start doing this on Mondays. You listen probably in the Chicago area or the greater tri-state region. You should know the roads of Chicago. This is WGN. Thank you, Don. John Williams in the Skyline Studios. After the news at 2:30, LF's always got a song on her mind. Why are you thinking about this one?
Matt Berninger, the frontman of The National, announced his upcoming solo album, Serpentine Prison. Yesterday, he released this solo song, which if you've seen Netflix's Between Two Ferns, the movie, you might recognize.
I'm not sure if it's Serpentine or Serpentine either, now that you mention it.
I panicked as I was saying. I didn't prepare for this.
Yes, you did. Every now and then I do that. I'll run into a word that I've seen a million times, and off the cuff, I'm like, I know that word. I know that word fine. I don't know if it's een or ein, you know, Steen or Stein. 2:38 on WGN Radio. Okay, we're going to do our little quiz now. Well, let's take caller number 5, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're playing for Blackhawks tickets. It's a Chicago quiz. You're listening to a Chicago radio station. You may have even been on the roads around here before. If you have, I like your chances. 312-981-7200. Call right now to play our quiz. And while you are calling, 815 texted in and said, hey, John, we were talking about, do you monitor your kids' social media? My high school nephew had two social networking accounts, one that his mother knew about and monitored closely, and the one she did not know about. I don't know how you get around that. How do you know what accounts your kids have, right? So you can say, Billy, assuming your kid's name is Billy, Billy, I want to see your account. Here's my account, Mom. I posted the thing about the thing. Okay, that's fine. But then Billy has another account.
Dr. Delecto.
it's Pierre Delecto, or all right. In this case, well, Pierre's already been taken, darn, so maybe it's Dr. Delecto. I don't know how you monitor that. It was easier when I was a kid, and you just said, be home by dark. Incidentally, Steve Bertrand is away this week. He's traveling with a bunch of WGN radio listeners. Another organization we do a lot of traveling with at this little radio station is Kelly Cruises. Go to kellycruises.com. And every now and then I mention in a commercial for them the trip that we're taking. I just wanted to tell you one of the stops. It's in Ephesus. So 1 year from today, Brenda and I and a bunch of WGN listeners will be on this cruise, which we love to take with our listeners. The boats are great. The stops are great. The best part is just making the friends that we make. And that really is the truth. Although I love those boats. we're going to be on the Regent Splendor. Anyway, one of the stops is Ephesus. I looked up Ephesus because I've seen it, but I wanted to know what I was talking about. Ephesus is an ancient Greek city on the coast of Ionia. It was built in the 10th century BC by Greek colonists. During the classical Greek era, it was one of the 12 cities of the Ionian League. Think about that. So this place was built in the 10th century BC. These buildings that you walk amongst, that you go through the doors of, the streets that you walk on are 12,000 years old, 10,000 years before Christ. I know you know all of that, but it's just mind-boggling to me when you're walking around this whole unearthed marble city and you go through the library and you walk through the condos and the public toilets that they had and you just imagine what life was like, that you are literally treading on the same spots that they did. The stone has been worn away from thousands of years of human use, and there you are walking on and touching the same spots. I just think it's mind-boggling. Ephesus was named for the nearby temple of Artemis, completed around 550 BC, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. You actually sit in the same seats that the spectators sat in their stadium, where there were human sacrifices, where slaves fought to the death. It's awful to think about, but it's the history and it's there. It's a 25,000-seat stadium, you know, that has tunnels, just like we do at Wrigley Field or Soldier Field or wherever. Ephesus was one of the seven churches of Asia that were cited in the book of Revelation. The Gospel of John may have been written there. The city was destroyed by the Goths. Thanks a lot, Goths. In 263, it was rebuilt again, and then again after an earthquake in 614 AD. It says here, the ruins are a favorite of international and local tourists. I agree. That'll be one of our stops. If you want to know more, go to kellycruises.com. Kellycruises.com. Okay, Eileen, are you going to take our little quiz? Thanks for joining us. How are you, Eileen?
All right, fine. Yeah, I'm going to try this. Uh-oh.
That's no way to approach a quiz.
I'm kind of scared because sometimes I wonder maybe I don't know that much of the city.
All right, I'm going to give you a lifeline to Don Kleppen. Don, are you still in there or have we changed out in the newsroom?
Nope, I am here, sir.
All right. Lapka, are you still around?
Of course.
I see Kevin in sports land. I'm not sure. Kevin's got his nose down like he's getting ready for the Rokan show. So maybe Kevin's not going to be a lifeline. But you've got a lifeline to Lauren Lapka. If you're not sure, reach out to Lauren. And if you're not sure, you can also one time reach out to Don Kleppen. Now, just for playing, this is the Mega Pros Quiz. Our Chicago quiz is sponsored by Mega Pros, making it fun to get things done. Just for playing, I'm going to get you the Mega Pros sweatshirt. Red or black sweatshirt. You're raking the leaves or doing some chores around. Great sweatshirt to have. If you get 8 of the 10 right, I've got Blackhawks tickets for you.
All right.
If you get all 10 right, we'll invite you back next Monday to play in the next round. But that's if you get all 10 right. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Drove to Chicago. All things know. All things know.
Our Chicago quiz today is transportation themed. Question number one. This is the longest road in the city. 27.38 miles. What is the name of the longest avenue in Chicago?
Western Avenue.
Western Avenue is right. Question number two. That jumble of concrete where 290, 90, and 94 meet is known as the what? The interchange of 290, 90, and 94, just west of the downtown. That intersection is known as the what?
Oh, you don't mean the Jane Byrne interchange, do you?
That is correct. Number three, this newly named road stretches from Grant Park West to the entrance to the Eisenhower Expressway. We called it Congress Avenue before, but that little stretch of road from Grant Park now to the Eisenhower is called what? Just changed its name.
It's not the Jane Addams, no. I'm not sure of this one.
Kleppen, you want to give her a hand? You can use a lifeline if you want to reach out to Don on this.
Yeah, I better use a lifeline.
Kleppen.
All right, so I just, as the lifeline, I just say the answer. Is that how this goes?
You can say whatever you want. This is a radio show.
That's true, right.
What advice do you give her? What do you think it is?
It's, you know, recently renamed. It was Congress. It was, there's another street that shares the same name.
Oh, that's really? I didn't know that.
Well, the last part of it, yes.
Yes, right. Thank you.
Not the full name, but the last part of it.
True.
Kleppen, what's your answer for her?
Ida B. Wells Drive.
You want to go with that?
Ida B. Wells Drive, yeah.
That's correct!
Yes.
You're three for three. The Ronald Reagan Memorial Highway is the relatively new name of what interstate?
Route 57?
Negative. That's I-88 out west.
Oh.
I-90 from Wisconsin to Indiana goes by four different names. What are they? You only need to get three of the four right on this one. I-90, you know it as the what?
The Dan Ryan.
Is one of them.
And the Skyway.
The Skyway is two.
Kennedy.
The Kennedy is three. So you got, and then there's one more. Bonus points.
Eden?
No, the Edens is 94. 90 would be the Jane Addams to O'Hare.
Oh, yeah.
That's all right. You still got that one right. How about this one? How much does the Illinois Tollway take in each year? A, $100 million. B, $400 million. C, $1.4 billion. How much does the tollway take in each year? A, B, or C?
I would say C.
C, $1.4 billion is right. I-55 is commonly known as?
Joliet. How many lifelines do I get? Do I get any more lifelines?
Yeah, you got Lauren Lapka in traffic, mind you. Hey, Lapka, you want to give her a hand on this one?
I'll give you a hint. Somebody who is not here today, who normally covers the news, has half of the name of this expressway.
Steve Bertrand? Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. Shut up, John.
Does that help?
Steve.
Not really.
The Stevenson.
Oh, the Stevenson.
Mm-hmm. Too late. You got it wrong.
Oh, come on.
How about this one? Addresses in Chicago are designated north or south when they are north or south of this avenue. Right?
Lake Street?
Lake Street is wrong. It's Madison. Madison.
Oh.
Similarly, addresses are designated east and west depending on which side of this street they're located.
It's not Cicero, is it?
It is
no.
State Street.
Oh, State Street.
Right, here's your last one. Are you ready?
Yeah.
You're doing just fine. You're doing just fine, Eileen. All right, here's your last one. This historic road begins downtown Chicago at East Adams, just west of Michigan Avenue, and it goes through Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, goes all the way to California. It ends in Santa Monica, 2,400 miles in total. What's this street?
It's got to be Route 66.
That's Route 66. You are absolutely right.
I'd say that was pretty good.
I think you did really well, Eileen.
Oh, man, I'm sweating over here.
I'm sweating, too. All right, so we've got the Mega Pro sweatshirt for you, and that's all. You're not returning as our reigning champion. You got to get all 10 right.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks a lot for giving me the opportunity to play and see how much I didn't know about
Chicago. I thought you did admirably. By the way, how long have you lived in Chicago? Do you live in the city?
I was born and raised in Evergreen Park. It's like 95th and Western. It's Little Company of Mary, but then I moved up north, about 30 years ago. Yeah, or no, even better than that. So I lived on the south side, and then I moved up north about more like 50 years ago. Yeah.
Right. Well, I worried that this one might be a little difficult for our inaugural Chicago quiz. We'll do another one next Monday. Hold on. Talk to producer Elif, okay?
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Eileen, thanks for listening. How'd you guys do on that one? Was that easy? Was that too hard?
There were some that were definitely challenging.
I thought that the most difficult one was I-90, the four names. I would have known Kennedy and Dan Ryan. I don't think I would have thought of the Skyway and the Jane Addams to O'Hare.
Yeah, I never think about the Jane Addams. And I also think about the Indiana Toll Road, but that technically is in Indiana, not to Indiana.
Right. So when I'm on the toll road a lot over there, but I guess I'm on the Skyway to get to the Chicago Skyway to get to the Indiana state line. So that's the Illinois side.
And then it gets complicated when you mix in the I-90-94 part.
Exactly, which would be the Kennedy downtown or the Dan Ryan downtown. Then it splits
part of the Bishop Ford.
We didn't even do the Edens. If you're not from Chicago, I'm sorry, but that's why I did this. These are our roads and how we talk about them. I think I got that right, didn't I? I said that we're going on that Kelly Cruz's trip 1 year from this week. That Kelly Cruz's cruise is going to visit Ephesus. Brenda and I have been there a couple times with a bunch of listeners. We're going to go again next year. And it says on Wikipedia that it was built in the 10th century B.C. Well, and some of you are saying, hey, John, no way is that city that old. You said 12,000 years. But if it was built in the 10th century B.C., right? A century is 1,000 years. That's 10,000 years before Christ. We're 2,000 years on this side. That's 12,000 years, right? So I don't know why you're fussing about that. John, did you say 10,000 years before Christ? That seems way too old. Well, it is really old. This texter says, hey, wow, that 12,000-year-old road you're going to visit next year, let me know how the potholes are. I hope they're better than the ones in Chicago. They don't have any potholes. I've been on there. There's divots. There's some cracks. I don't think marble gets potholes the way asphalt does. Tickets. Hey, we've got tickets to the Blackhawks. Yeah, where did I put that? Stand by. Here it is. Got it right here. Okay, I've got a pair of tickets to the Blackhawks versus the Philadelphia Flyers. The game is this Thursday, October 24th, courtesy of Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, and Plumbing. For all the right reasons, Four Seasons. Find them online at FourSeasonsHeatingAndCooling.com. FourSeasonsHeatingCooling.com. Tune into the Rokan Show at 4:40 today for another chance to wear a pair of Chicago Blackhawks tickets from Four Seasons. We've got them right now for caller number 7-312-981-7200. Caller number 7-312-981-7200. Kevin, are you heads up over there in Sportsland?
Hello, John.
That's what I thought. I got 60 seconds. Give me your thoughts on the Bears.
I've got a rant loaded up and ready to fire out right after our 3 o'clock news, but the gist of it is it was embarrassing, it was pathetic, and it was atrocious. Matt Nagy was horrible. Mitch Trubisky was horrible. The defense, tough to really get on their case considering the time of possession was so lopsided. It seems like they were on the field the entire game, and special teams were bad again. So all around an embarrassment for the Bears.
You know, we didn't have the Bears postgame show with the three Bears.
Mm-hmm.
So
you'll get a taste of Ed Obradovich today at 4:40.
One quick question for you. By the way, we do have a winner to the Blackhawks tickets. Nicholas, congratulations. You can stop calling. We've got our winner of the Blackhawks tickets. Is it possible to save Trubisky a little bit by saying that the line is not giving him enough protection?
I don't think I'd go that far. The line hasn't been good, but a large part of the struggles when it comes to pass protection has been the lack of production with the running game, which has been non-existent. 7 carries yesterday, John. That's a franchise low for the Bears.
Sounds like he's ready to go. Hey, thanks for listening to my podcast. This is John Williams. I'm live weekdays from 1 to 3. And remember, our Mincing Rascals podcast drops Thursdays at 5. The Rascals is a round table of talkers and journalists. This year, judged best in the state by the Illinois Broadcasters Association.